Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Listeners, as we start, I want you to know that this next segment focuses on eating disorders, if that's a subject that's particularly difficult for you. The holidays are a time for friends and family and food. For those who struggle with an eating disorder, it can be a time of pain and stress, and it's a feeling that can last year-round. So joining us to talk more about the challenges of the season and resources available to help is Dr. Holly Peake, Assistant Medical Director of the Klarman Eating Disorder Center at McLean Hospital. Dr. Peake, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Jessie Felber, a master's student studying social work at the University of New Hampshire. She has also recovered from anorexia nervosa. Jessie, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
We want to invite you to pull up a chair at the table, listeners. This is a hard subject, but one that can be helpful to talk about, to ask questions about, to think about for your loved ones or family members. Call us. What do you want to know? What stories do you have to share? How can you find help? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So, Dr. Peake, I'm going to start with you. I have a few questions for you, and then, Jessie, I'm going to turn to you to share some of your story. Dr. Peake, how does one diagnose an eating disorder? What are signs to look for?
Yeah, so I think the first thing to know is that eating disorders can come in many shapes and sizes. And so in order to be diagnosed with an eating disorder, you should really go see a medical professional. But the three eating disorders we really think about are anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa, and binge eating disorder. So anorexia nervosa is mainly characterized by someone who restricts food intake to the point that they have a low body weight and can be quite malnourished. They may do other compensatory things that can also impact their body weight, like excessive exercise, purging, laxative use. But the main characterization of it is the malnutrition and low body weight. When we think of bulimia nervosa, those people can be characterized as a pattern of binge eating and purging. They may or may not be low body weight, and typically they aren't low body weight. And so it's hard to kind of see on the outside. Both with anorexia and bulimia, psychologically, people often have an overvaluation of their body shape and size.
Meaning they overemphasize or overfocus on it?
Overfocus on it, yes. They may have a thin ideal in their mind of something that they want to look like or something that they're striving for. And so that can be a psychological basis of how anorexia and bulimia can be developed. We also have binge eating disorder, which is quite different than anorexia and bulimia. People with binge eating disorder can often be overweight or obese, and they don't have the same sort of compensatory mechanisms people use to lose weight. It's just strictly binge eating.
So, Dr. Peake, my understanding is that often people seek to hide the signs that might be telling to their loved ones or their friends or family
Absolutely.
That they're experiencing an eating disorder. So what are those signs? How does one look for or see them?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think that with eating disorders, often there can be a lot of shame and secrecy involved. And so it can be often hard for loved ones to see what's going on. But if you have a loved one who seems like they're avoiding eating with others, they may not be enjoying doing the same things they used to be doing. Food and socializing with eating can be a very common thing in our culture. People with an eating disorder might start avoiding those things. Or if you see a loved one have a significant amount of weight loss in a short amount of time, that could certainly be a warning sign as well.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Elisa in West Roxbury is ready to pull up a seat at the table. Thank you for calling, Elisa. What would you like to share with Dr. Peake and Jessie?
Just to say, I had a disorder, but I also say I still have one. I recovered from anorexia and bulimia, and I just think it is important during this time of year that people just keep diet language just as a very private thing and not something they may be talking about at work or in front of others, and to make sure you aren't food policing other people as well. If you think you should say something about what people are eating, you probably shouldn't.
Thank you for that. I really appreciate you sharing your story, Elisa. And actually, this is a time to turn to Jessie. You've recovered from anorexia nervosa. Thank you for being willing to share your story. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, thank you for giving me a platform to share about what my journey has looked like. So for me, my struggle with anorexia really took off when I entered college. During that time in a person's life, it's such a huge transition. And for me, all of the transitions I was dealing with really manifested in a lot of anxiety that I hadn't dealt with before. This anxiety made it really hard for me to be around my friends, for me to really feel like I was present in the classes that I was in. So as a way to kind of manage that anxiety, I started working hard, working very hard in my classes, trying to kind of distract myself from the anxious feelings and insecurities I was dealing with. And this segue is always a little bit awkward to loop in, but at the same time, I was in a college nutrition course, and we completed this project called a diet analysis project. And what you did when you did this project is you had to record everything that you ate for 3 days, and then the project kind of spit out results that told you areas in your diet and exercise regimen that were going well, and then areas that were maybe could be improved. And for me, I was really so used to pushing myself and trying to overachieve in everything I was doing that seeing those results really became an opportunity for me to try to perfect my diet and exercise. And so began this journey of really hyper-focusing on food, hyper-focusing and obsessing on exercise. And, you know, what started as small modifications to my diet and exercise habits turned into what became anorexia over the course of about 2 years. And by the time that I was in a place that I required residential treatment to really get myself back on track, I was thinking about food and exercise from the moment I woke up to the second that I went to sleep. And it was just really taking away like the parts of my life that were joyful.
Dr. Peek, I see you nodding a lot during that part of Jesse's story. What are your reactions?
Yeah. So, Jesse, when you mentioned that how this started in a nutrition course, that didn't surprise me at all, because I think a lot of eating disorders do start with diets gone out of control. And particularly in this culture where in pop culture, there's all these fad diets and in different ways to achieve X, Y, and Z. Some people are able to diet and let it go. Some people, you know, particularly if they're more prone to anxiety or depression or OCD or have some other sort of things or troubles with transitions, like Jesse was describing, it can kind of take over. So that's not an uncommon story that I hear.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK if you'd like to join the conversation. And we'd like you to join the conversation. Kim is calling now from Newton. Hi, Kim. What would you like to share with Jesse and Dr. Peek?
Well, I'd like to ask for help. I'm a former runway model. My best friend had bulimia. I now have 3 girls, and I'm in shock over the way the models look in the catalogs that arrive at our house or on Instagram where my girls are all active. The sample size now is known to be a 00. Some of these models that my kids are getting catalogs and bombarded with ads are so skinny, it's scary. And we need to do something about this. I don't see anything happening. I'm just wondering, are doctors aware of this? There's a lot of kids at Newton, for example. They found a recent mental health survey, 30 to 40% feel bad about the way they look. So maybe they're not, quote unquote, you know, having an eating disorder yet that can be treated, but they're certainly in a body dysmorphic or on their way or feeling bad because they don't look like, you know, these extreme versions being held up to them. I'm just wondering, what can we do?
Thank you, Kim, for that question. Dr. Peek?
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. And I think this is something that we're all aware of and something I see also common, particularly in treatment of adolescents and young adults who are bombarded by media messages really 24/7 now, because with social media and access even on your phone to these thin, idealized messages, it can be really problematic. So yes, absolutely. I think it's problematic and something we're aware of and tricky to kind of know what to do about it. I think the more and more people in the media are having conversations about it and trying to make a change in the model industry, like you mentioned, I think It can be very helpful, but it's so, so slow going. I think on more of a local place, what we can do within families and really within schools, too, is more media literacy education. And how can we teach our kids to be more critically analyze the messages they're getting in the media?
Jesse, what about you from your own experience?
Yeah. And I mean, I think this is such a huge topic and something that has a complicated answer. But for me, the reason that I choose to be open about my story and my struggle is because I think the reality is there are a lot more people that have struggled with eating disorders or their relationship with their body, but we just aren't talking about it. Some of the media that's thrown at us as starting from a very young age is so detrimental. But if we're not creating a space for kids to be able to come to adults or people they trust in their life to talk about how ridiculous these images are, then we're not going to be able to show kids that really the expectations they might have for their body aren't healthy.
Jesse, what does that look like when an adult creates a space for a kid to come to them and say, I'm disturbed by what I'm seeing, or I feel bad because I don't look like what I'm seeing? What does that space look like?
I think one of the best ways to help create that space as an adult is to really be looking at your own relationship with food and your body. So making sure that when you're around children or anyone, that you're really keeping that diet talk limited, that you're talking about food as something that is a fuel for our body, something that has so many benefits. Too often food can be labeled as good or bad when the reality is food is meant to be enjoyed. It serves a purpose for us. It helps. It's the energy that gives us what we need to live lives. And so I think that if we can use more compassionate language about food and our bodies around children, that could be a good way to welcome that conversation.
Dr. Peek, the other thing I thought of when Kim called from Newton, she talked about she's a woman. Her friend in Florida was a woman. She talked about her daughters. But young men and men can experience eating disorders as well, correct?
Absolutely. Yes. And I think more and more we're starting to recognize that this isn't only a women's health and women's mental health issue. This is an everybody's health and everybody's mental health issue. And I think that it's been so stigmatized that it's a woman's problem that oftentimes men and young boys haven't felt like they had a space to talk about and also haven't been asked the questions either, because the conversation has always been focused on it's a women's health issue. But I think we're starting to recognize more and more that this is something that young men struggle with as well, particularly when you think of like the media messages that we were talking about, wanting to have a particular muscular look. That tends to be kind of the media message that is sent out there, that the body image that men strive for.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Jane is on the line from Concord. Hi, Jane. Do you want to share your story?
Hi. Yes. Thank you for taking my call. This is a subject near and dear to my heart because I'm a mother of a daughter who has had anorexia for 15 years. But there were two points, really, I wanted to make. One is that now as a 30-year-old, she's doing very well. But the first point is that she's doing very well because of all the professional help that she got. And there are things that we would do differently as a family. But one thing we did do, I think, that really made a difference was to make sure that she had therapy, we had therapy, we lined up the doctors, she's been in residential programs, and she's really bought into all of that. So if there are parents listening out there that are worried, that can make such a huge difference.
Jane, I know you had a second point too, but I've got my lines are filling up, and I want to have a chance to pick up on your first point with our panelists. So I'm going to thank you for that, and I'm also going to tell you I'm glad that your daughter's doing better. How did you know, Jesse, to get help?
It was a very long road. And I think to what the caller had said, it's so important that you get the right level of care. For me, I think I started noticing that I really needed to get more help when I stopped enjoying things in my life that were once enjoyable. I always, whenever I talk about this, I use the example of my nephews and boys that have always brought so much joy in my life. And I remember being with them when I was really actively struggling and not feeling the same joy that I had felt. And not because anything about them was wrong. It was just because I was just so exhausted. So that's when I knew that I needed to call and get a higher level of support. But it wasn't easy living. I'm from New Hampshire. And when I had sought help first, the only treatment center was about an hour away from where I lived, and it had just opened up literally a couple of months earlier. So it was certainly not an easy road.
I want to take a moment to share the National Eating Disorders Association hotline with our listeners. If you are looking for help, one of the numbers you can call is that hotline, 1-800-931-2237. That's 1-800-931-2237. And we do have a list of resources on our website, which is radioboston.org. Dr. Peek, where does someone even start when they are looking for the help for themselves or for a loved one, for a child?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, like the caller mentioned, it often takes a team of professionals to kind of diagnose and treat what's going on in a lot of these patients. But I think the best place to start is with a primary care physician. And I think that for a couple of reasons. Number one is most people have a primary care physician. All kids should have a pediatrician. And a pediatrician can make sure a person is medically stable. A pediatrician and primary care physician could also have resources to refer to a psychiatrist and a psychologist if the patient needs more help in other areas, needs medications. And everyone needs regular therapy, too. I think the caller mentioned that as well. A primary care physician can also refer to a dietitian, because I think dietary counseling is so important also in the treatment of this illness.
I'd like to take another call. We have Joanna or Johanna, I'm sorry, I don't know which, on the line from Marlboro. Hi, how do you pronounce your name?
Yes, it's Joanna.
Joanna, welcome to the show. What would you like to share?
Thank you. Well, first of all, I just have to say I've been listening, and I feel like everything that's been said is spot on. I am currently a 44-year-old woman who is working towards recovery from an eating disorder that really didn't come on for me until I was 37. So I think it's really important, as you know, we're all talking about this, to realize that it might not just be your adolescence. Everything that the panelists and the callers have said may also apply to maybe your sibling, your cousin, your neighbors, your friends. And we, even as adults, may still need the same level of support. So, you know, supportive conversation, avoiding maybe analyzing food or exercising routines, you know, all of that. In answer to one of the earlier callers, actually, what can we do? We can all work on that.
Joanna, that's such a helpful reminder. Dr. Peek, you look like you wanted to react to that.
Yeah, I just thought that was such an excellent point that she brought up, because I think that the first step is that people need to ask the right questions of people to help people figure out what exactly is going on. And oftentimes, myself, even professionals may have stereotypes in their head of like who is at high risk, and may neglect that to ask someone like men or people in their 30s, like the caller mentioned, to ask the appropriate questions. So I just thought that was such an excellent point.
Let's grab one more call if we've got time. This is Sable from Waltham. Go ahead, Sable.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I wanted to go back to Kim's point earlier. She called and
Kim
asked
from Newton.
About... Yes, the catalogs and her daughters. And like the doctor mentioned, it is really slow movement on like the national scale. However, we do have great tools now to be able to curate our own feeds, like going on Instagram and searching for body positive hashtags, things that are not fat phobic, and really just diversifying your own Instagram feed, your own Facebook feed, and trying to step away from those more popularized ideals.
Thank you for that. Sable, I think that's a good chance to ask Jesse, have you changed your social media or other kinds of consumption, you know, media consumption habits as part of your recovery process?
Yes, I have. I think that when you embark on a journey through recovery, you're really changing a lot about your lifestyle. And so I think that was an excellent point to bring up, to be looking for those body positive hashtags on different media. outlets. And so I've changed that. When I was really struggling with my eating disorder, I had a Fitbit that I do not have anymore, because for me, that was a really triggering tool to have on me, and something that really just complemented some of the obsessive tendencies I was dealing with.
So, Dr. Peek, we have about a minute left, and I couldn't get to the caller, but we had a caller who wanted advice on how to talk to a child in the middle of treatment for an eating disorder. So I thought maybe you could address that a little bit.
Yeah. You know, it can be such a delicate situation. And I think just allowing a child to have an open space and to feel comfortable within the family or with their support system to be able to talk about anything and everything that is bothering them. And I think just creating that culture within your family is really important too, and kind of set the basis that it's okay to ask for help and to seek help from mental health counselor, psychiatrist, therapist.
Jesse, last quick word for you.
Just that recovery is not a linear process. There are a lot of twists and turns and highs and lows, and to be willing to walk through that with your child that might be struggling.
With that is Jesse Felber, a master's student studying social work at the University of New Hampshire. She also recovered from anorexia nervosa. Thank you, Jesse.
Thank you.
And Dr. Holly Peek, assistant medical director of the Klarman Eating Disorder Center at McLean Hospital. Thank you, Dr. Peek, for coming in.
Thank you.
One more time, listeners, you can find a list of resources on our website, radioboston.org. And the National Eating Disorders Association hotline is 1-800-931-2237. Lastly, WBUR will be talking about eating and health as part of a new podcast called Food, We Need to Talk, which explores how we can improve our relationship with food. The podcast comes out next week, but you can actually listen to a preview of it on our website now at radioboston.org, and you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts. So that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.